You're listening to Season 1 of Teaching Yoga, a podcast by me, Cora Giroux. I believe yoga teachers are on the front line of health and healing in the Western world, so I created this podcast to support the people that support the people. Each week, we cover topics that matter to you, like inclusivity, accessibility, and diversity, how to make a sustainable living doing this work, and how we as teachers can be a positive voice in the changing landscape of yoga. This show is a space for real, raw conversation, a place to remind you that you're not alone, and a resource for your life and work on the spiritual path. If you want to stay connected between shows, find me on Instagram. It's just my name, CoraGeroux. I haven't yet.
Yeah. We had to bet. I'm only here. Yeah. You know? If you don't like this music, then don't be listening to it. You know, I'm just a dude that you know, or something similar. If you don't keep it real.
Oh, hey there. Welcome back. How you been? Things here in Australia are continuing to change day by day, as I'm sure they are wherever you are listening to this podcast from. I'm recording this on the last day of April, which is actually the first day, or not the first day, but the day the first workshop inside of the Teachers Club comes out. And the Teachers Club is like basically run on a democracy. People vote for what content they want me to cover. And they all voted to do the first workshop, or at least the majority did, on confidence. And that is something that I never would have chosen. But I'm actually really happy and excited that that's what we did in the first workshop. So I've spent the last couple of weeks just getting that ready to deliver to the Teachers Club members, and, you know, learned a lot, mostly that no matter how long you've been doing what you're doing and no matter how much training and education you have, we're all just human, right? And we often doubt ourselves, no matter what it is that we're putting out there into the world. Like, I know I had like a total freak out where I was like, oh my God, as soon as I deliver this workshop, every single person is going to cancel their membership for sure. Like, definitely. It's no other option. But, you know, that didn't happen. So it's really just our own inner self-talk, I think, that really gets in the way for most of us. So that was fun and interesting. Something new, or kind of like new again, that I want to tell you guys about is how much I've been enjoying connecting with teachers one-on-one. I have been, in the last couple of weeks, I've had the opportunity to do a couple of mentoring sessions with you guys. And I really, really enjoy knowing what is going on for you and then using the experience and the knowledge that I have to help out in whatever way I can. I know it's a weird time for everyone, but also as a yoga teacher with our industry being shut down. So if you would like to do a one-on-one mentoring session with me, I'm going to give one away free every month for the foreseeable future, to people who leave a review for the podcast on iTunes. So how this is going to work is simply leave a review on iTunes or any other platform that you listen to this where you can leave a review, and just take a screenshot of that review on your phone and then email it to TL. So TL is my assistant. Her email is support, just the word, at CoraGiroux.com. So if you want an opportunity to win a 60-minute one-on-one mentoring session with me, we just do it over Zoom. You can ask me anything you want, and I'll do my best to answer in the best way that I can with my skills and experience. If you want an opportunity to win one of those, And remember, this is going to go on kind of indefinitely. So no matter when you're listening to this show, just leave a review, take a screenshot, send that screenshot to support@corajaru.com, and we will enter you into the draw to win. I will announce the first winner on the first episode that comes out in June. And then every episode, the first episode of the month, I'll just announce the winner for the last month. I just really want to be able to connect with you guys in a deeper way. And I know finances are often a barrier for a lot of us. So just by leaving a review, there's like that tiny little energy exchange there. And hopefully I can help you out. So on today's show, I speak with Manoj Dias. And Manoj is the founder of Aspace, which if you live in Australia, you might have heard of. It's Australia's first drop-in meditation studio. And Manoj is also a global ambassador for Lululemon. He was featured in the top 20 teachers of color to watch in 2020 list. And I actually had the pleasure of meeting Manoj in person late in 2019. He came to Sydney to do a workshop on anxiety and burnout, both of which I know very well. So I was really excited to actually come connect with Manoj in person. And it took us a little while to tee up this interview, but I was really, really excited to speak with Manoj about his experience as a meditation teacher, because he's so open about that balancing act between being a normal human being, having a normal human being life, but also being someone that people look to for guidance, especially during challenging times. And I know for a lot of teachers I've spoken with, that line can be a tricky one to walk, because there are a lot of expectations placed on yoga teachers and meditation teachers. And as I speak with Manoj about, there are also ethical principles that we sort of take on when we take on these roles, but we're still normal human people. So how do we balance those two things? And Manoj and I really get into this in the episode. We also discuss the difference between shamatha and vipassana meditation and how the Buddha was the first psychologist. Manoj breaks down when it's probably a good idea to be using an app for meditation, like when that is the right tool for you, but then also when you might need to take the next step and actually find a meditation teacher. And then I ask, like, well, how do you actually do that? And he shares two really important things to look for when choosing a meditation teacher. And he used the phrase, like, you need to be mindful of who you let into your mind. And I thought that was really, really helpful. So it's nice to have his advice on that. And then we also talk about Buddhist ethics. So the five precepts and the Eightfold Path, which I think is really interesting, especially if we're coming or you're coming from a yoga background where we have the yamas and the niyamas. It's nice to see how a different tradition actually lays out their ethical frameworks as well. So I hope you enjoy this episode with Manoj. Remember, if you're into a one-on-one with me, leave a review, send a screenshot, and we will put you in the draw to win. I hope you enjoy the show. Hey, Manoj, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Oh, such a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I've been wanting to speak with you for a long time, so I'm super, super excited to have you here. And in like preparation for this interview, excuse me, and usually every interview I do, I usually like do some hardcore stalking on the guest before they actually come on the show. And of course, you're no exception to that. So I heard that one of your like most hated questions ever is like, tell me what you do. So I'm going to refrain from asking you.
I'm going to refrain from asking you that question.
And I think that, I mean, you've been interviewed a lot. So if people actually want to know that answer to that question, they'll just type your name into iTunes or whatever, and they can listen to another podcast, which I would highly recommend they do. But
that's
instead
really sweet.
Of that,
thank you.
Yeah, I mean, might as well. You've repeated yourself, I'm sure, 1,000 times. So instead of that, let's just dive straight into it. You're a meditation teacher. the people who listen to this show are yoga teachers, very similar line of work. Could you share like the biggest challenge that you've had as a meditation teacher over the years?
Yeah, I mean, like the biggest challenge, I don't know if I could narrow it down to just one. I have so many. You know, there's the challenges of navigating my own conditioned responses and tendencies, navigating my own trauma, untangling from being a teacher all the time, the economics of teaching, the balancing of being a CEO of a company and a teacher. Like, I don't know if I could narrow down to just one, but
top 10.
I've got 10, and depending on how much time we have, I can go through all of them.
Yeah, it's I think it's nice actually to hear that, because it's not what we expect when we get into teaching yoga or teaching meditation as a profession. The outside sort of viewpoint is that you're just calm all the time and life is really like chill, and it's not always the case. Any of those that you want to speak to in particular?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that you just kind of said it in that last comment is what I've really had to navigate myself is the idea of being a teacher versus the reality of being a teacher, and this constant oscillating that I feel of being really guilty for feeling very human responses. You know, I think in the middle of a pandemic, what's been coming up for me, and I shared this with you when we spoke before, is like, you know, like so much trauma. And then, you know, the conditioned responses to that trauma. And then what follows that is usually the judgment of like, oh no, you've been doing this for more than a decade. Why are you still doing it? You're not getting anywhere. Like, you shouldn't be a teacher. Like, again, these are conditioned responses. But I think that the biggest lesson that I've taken away is humility, humility of my humanity, that no matter how much I practice and who I practice with and what insights I get, that, you know, I'm still in this human body, still going through all of these different experiences and just trying the best that I can. And when I layer in that judgment that I should know better because I'm a teacher, then my life becomes infinitely harder.
Yeah, I when I first moved to Australia, I'd been teaching yoga for just a couple of years, 2 or 3 years. And so I met all new people when I moved here. Obviously, I'm from Canada. And one of the girls that I met her in a social way first, rather than being a yoga teacher to her. So we met sort of as peers. And then later she realized I was a yoga teacher. And she said, you know what? Until I met you, I thought my yoga teacher had her shit together. And I was like, yeah, I'm glad I really brought that down off the pedestal for you. But it is something that I think a lot of teachers have brought to me in conversation that they struggle with about being human, but also being a teacher. So thanks for sharing that.
No, I think it's a really important thing. And I think the more we acknowledge as teachers our humanity, the better it actually makes us to teach. You know, the more relatable I find I am to people when I acknowledge my shortcomings and my, my conditioning. But also it kind of, you know, it takes away like that power imbalance that's sometimes there in classrooms as well, when we can just acknowledge that, hey, we're human. We make, you know, so many mistakes. We're just trying to do the best that we can. We might be a little bit further down the meditative path, you know, than a complete beginner, but by no means have, you know, I speak for myself, by no means have I attained any level of enlightenment.
Yeah, I think I'm safe to say that as well. When I was listening to you speak about what you do, you mentioned that you teach secular mindfulness. And I was just wondering if you could give us like your definition of what that actually is.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's necessarily secular mindfulness, but more I would say it's Buddhist-informed mindfulness practice. I teach to secular audiences largely, but it's generally very much Buddhist-informed mindfulness practice. And, you know, a bit of background into my teaching is a lot of my teaching has been in the Theravada Buddhist tradition, coming out of Sri Lanka. But in the last, 3 years, it's been very much in the Tibetan system of Buddhist training. And there's a specific set of teachings that I've really been trained to teach. I wouldn't say I'm a Dharma teacher by any stretch of the imagination. Like I've only had like really 10, 12 years of practice. But, what I tend to bring to my classes when I teach in different audiences is the traditional teachings of mindfulness. And that is really that it's not just about stress relief. It's not just about personal well-being. It's about collective well-being. It's about liberation. It's about the elimination of greed, hatred, and delusion. And I try to bring that because I think it's really important that that we talk about how mindfulness has perhaps been, I wouldn't know what the word here is, mindfulness perhaps been distorted somewhat from where it came from. And that has inherent value, but it also has some downfalls. I'm really lucky that the audiences that I've taught to, secular audiences, have really been receptive to some of these traditional teachings and provided vibrant discussion when they haven't been.
Yeah, and you said something that I really want to touch on, which is that you're not a Dharma teacher per se, and you've only been teaching you've been practicing for 10 or 12 years. And this is an interesting thing because I think in our culture right now, we would think 10 or 12 years is a really, really long fucking time. But you said it as if it's not. And I know that, in other modalities, like if you're a clinical psychologist in Australia, you need to do at least 8 years of training in order to, from my understanding, to actually teach the Dharma, you would need to study with a teacher in a particular lineage for a very, very long time, like decades. Correct me if I'm wrong there, but like a lot of people right now are teaching meditation with like zero training, not just like minimal training. Like in yoga, we talk about like how 200 hours is not enough, but like sometimes people are teaching meditation with nothing. Under their belt. Can you speak to that at all? Like what's going on with that?
Yeah, I actually had to laugh there because it brought, just this morning I was on Instagram and I saw that Diddy was leading a guided meditation. And, it just kind of made me laugh that, Lizzo and Diddy and Nick Jonas are leading meditations. And to me, it brings up the question of what is meditation and who owns the word. I come from a particular lineage and a particular set of philosophies that really regard the role of a meditation teacher as being a really vital component of someone's life. And that has ramifications, especially karmically, but also psychologically on someone's life. So, my teacher told me I'd have to study with him for 10 years before I could even be considered a teacher. Luckily he relinquished after 4 years, but I was set for that practice. But I think it's really important to consider what we define as meditation, because there are, breathing exercises that, people are calling meditations. There's listening to beautiful music that people are calling meditations. There's, someone reciting poetry that's referred to as meditations. So the word meditation, I feel, has got a little skewed, and that in my understanding has multiple variations now. I think when it gets tricky and when it gets more nuanced is when we start to talk about the impact of what they're teaching, because most people, especially in the Buddhist practice, come to the practice from some sort of suffering, whether that's chronic stress or, just discomfort with their lives, to more serious things like addictions and trauma and serious healing that they need. So the role of a teacher is so important in that particular practice, in that particular moment, because, there's trauma that can be created. There is, there's psychological damage that can be done. There is so many implications of that. But then, when we look at the breathing exercises example that I gave before, or, someone on Instagram leading like a 5-minute music meditation, the impact of that might be minimal. But I think it comes down to really the practice and analyzing the motivations of the teacher, you know, because I think all people really do mean well, all teachers that perhaps aren't qualified to specifically teach meditations. I think they come from a good place and they mean well, but perhaps they don't understand the impact of that on someone's psyche, you know, because words have power and there's a level of vulnerability that we're getting into when we really start to explore meditation.
Yeah, and in thinking about that, I was wondering, like contrasting with yoga, for example, I don't really see many people teaching yoga without at least 200 hours of certification. Like for a while, Britney Spears was doing yoga on her Instagram, but like, you know, people who are seriously like claiming to like join me for a guided yoga class or something, that's not really happening. At least not that I've seen in the yoga world. But it does, as you just mentioned, it does happen all the time with meditation. And I wonder, I mean, just pondering on this, is it because, or part of the reason is because like the body is a physical thing and people associate yoga with asana. So they're teaching asana and they don't want to, you know, do something that would, you know, pull someone's hamstring or whatever. But with meditation, the mind and the emotions, the psyche, as you say, like it's invisible. So people don't necessarily see the potential for harm in the same way. I don't know if I'm just like grasping at threads here, but like,
no, I think you're
why
right.
Does that happen?
Well, I think it's a few reasons. I think one, people think it's really easy to teach meditation. You know, it's just like literally saying soothing words, like notice your breath or something like that. Like, and people genuinely think it's pretty easy. And, you know, from the outside looking in, it might seem like that, but, you know, as a teacher, you're learning the nuances of your words, the impact of those words, when to use your words, when to give space, how to look out for people that are, you know, coming to you with trauma, how to look out for people that are causing harm through the words that you're using. So it's a lot more nuanced than that. But also I think that generally it comes down to the fact that it looks really easy. Right. If you can use soothing words and say something in a soothing tone, that, you know, we can do it. But the other side of this argument is that who gets to decide what is meditation and what is not? You know, I've studied in Sri Lanka. I've studied with monks before I even actually did a formal teacher training. And, you know, in the Western world, we might not, you know, especially in the first couple of years, we might not recognize that as training. But when you've sat with realized masters, you have a strong argument that, you know, your 100 hours means little if I've actually sat with people that have actually, you know, developed a certain level of wisdom and insight. So, A, it's hard to regulate. You know, in most countries, there's no regulation when it comes to meditation. And again, I think the word meditation has been so skewed that we don't really know. I don't really know often like what people mean when they say I'm a meditation teacher or I do meditation.
Yeah. What would you see would be like a remedy to that? Like, do you think that meditation should be regulated, or like, would there be, you know, people who are prominent in the field kind of like taking a bit of a stand on it? Like, how do you think that's like, what would the solution be for that? So people, when they are looking for meditation, they're getting someone who actually knows a little bit about what they're doing.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really hard thing to police and to manage. You know, I think it's really up to the student. You know, I think it's really up to the student to be discerning and to choose wisely who they let into their mind, you know, because one, like all you might be looking for is some temporary relief through breathing exercises or like a secular practice. And, you know, maybe you just need some guidance, you know, and in that case, it's probably okay that, you know, you're going on YouTube and getting some lessons from someone that you don't know who's qualified by. where it gets tricky and where it gets shady is if you want to really explore the deeper elements to meditation practice, or the teacher starts to talk about things that are outside this therapeutic application. That's where, you know, it's really on the onus of the student to be mindful of who they're trusting. I know there's, you know, people that are trying to regulate the industry, and I support that. I think there is probably a level of regulation that we need, but, you know, we're seeing in the age of Instagram, that's so hard to police, you know, so it's almost a futile practice.
Yeah. And I think when we think about meditation, it is really helpful. And same thing with yoga, I think, really. It is really helpful, as you mentioned, to sort of, I don't know if I want to say like categorize it into therapeutic and liberatory practices, I guess maybe would be the language around it. And knowing your intention, like what do you actually want to get out of a meditation practice or a yoga practice? And just for people listening who haven't really thought about it in that way, would you mind explaining kind of like what, like a definition even of like what would be a therapeutic application so people know what we're talking about of meditation, and then what some of the liberatory practices, or the, I guess, deeper could be a word, deeper practices are, or the result of them, I guess.
It's probably important to maybe call out the fact that both can exist together. You know, especially in the Buddhist tradition, we initially start off with a practice called shamatha, which is a foundational mindfulness practice. And this is a way for us to just calm our minds down, to calm the nervous system down, to almost let the ripples of our thoughts and thinking calm down. And the second stage of that is the vipassana, which is to see into the mind. And the reason we do that is because when our minds are really overactive, when they're super busy, when we're filled with stress and anxiety, and when our perceptions are clouded, it's really hard to see into the mind. It's almost like looking at a pond, and when it's wavy, when there's ripples, you can't see down into the bottom. But when the pond is calm, you can actually see what's there. You can see through to the rocks and the fish that are down the bottom. And so in that respect, they can both exist together. I think that the definition that I would give in answer to your question is that some of the therapeutic practices could be practices like MBSR, for example, mindfulness-based stress reduction, where, you know, you pay attention to the present moment with a non-judgmental attitude. And in this process, there is, you know, marketed health benefits from that. You know, we activate certain regions of our brain known as the hippocampus, the frontal cortex, and this has flow-on effects like, you know, greater focus, improved empathy and connection, and improved sleep. So, you know, doing things like that can be very, very beneficial for anyone. Yoga nidra is another practice. Maybe even some breathwork practices you could throw in there as well. Liberatory practices in the Buddhist perspective is kind of when we take that next step, where we don't just try to therapize our problems, where, you know, if we're feeling anxious or stressed, we don't just try to calm ourselves down, but we actually want to understand why we're stressed, why we're anxious, and we want to uproot that completely. You know, so we want to stop that suffering from happening again. So we actually go into the investigation of why that's there. And essentially what we're trying to eliminate in that process is the views and the perceptions that we have about ourselves and each other. And, you know, from a Theravada perspective, really uproot, you know, greed, hatred, delusion, which are, you know, causes of suffering. You know, same as like, you know, the four causes of suffering, like suffering of change, suffering of impermanence, suffering of just all pervasive suffering, lots of different ways that we try to suffer. And we are trying to essentially uproot that completely, as opposed to just essentially put a Band-Aid over what we're feeling and feel good for that moment.
Yeah, I think as you were like listing those causes of suffering, I was thinking like everyone's going through all of those right now.
Yeah.
It would be a really interesting time to practice.
Yeah. Interesting and challenging at the same time.
Totally. Yeah. I don't say interesting as I mean like fun. just potentially
interestingly challenging.
Fruitful maybe if you're up for it. And do you see a lot of people, like what I see in yoga, and I'm assuming it's probably similar in meditation, is that often what draws people to the practice, understandably, is the therapeutic benefits. And once they have received those therapeutic benefits, like, you know, sleeping better, maybe they're a bit more calm and slightly less reactive. And oftentimes that like opens up space to be even interested in looking deeper. Have you noticed that journey with students that you've taught and interacted with? And what does that journey typically look like?
Absolutely. I think my own journey was very similar. I think it gets to a point where you realize that, you know, for me, I'll talk about myself. It got to a point that no matter how much meditation or how much yoga or how many green juices I drank or, you know, what diets I went, what exercises that I did, there was still this feeling of being unsettled, and there was still suffering there. There was still craving there. You know, I wanted to buy new clothes. I wanted to, you know, spend money on this thing. And I was reacting in this way to my loved one. So there was still like this surface level agitation that was still there. And I realized that no matter what I practiced, it was still going to be there. So I had to really understand it. And so when I got really curious about understanding is when I started to really follow the Buddhist path a lot more seriously. You know, I was born and raised in a Buddhist household. But, you know, growing up in the West, I kind of lost that connection to an extent. And so for me, really beginning to study myself really opened me up to these practices. And, you know, many people refer to the Buddha as the first psychologist, right? Because essentially what we're looking at is the problem, which is our minds. We're trying to diagnose the problem, and then we're trying to, you know, give ourselves a prescription for that. And that was really what drew me in. And I think that's really what draws a lot of other students in, is that they get to a place where there's, you know, similar to you, like a curiosity, like what else is there? What else happens if I take, it's like the Matrix, if I take the red pill instead of the blue pill. And I think, you know, for me, like I couldn't unsee things once I started to go down that path. I couldn't turn my back on, you know, what I was seeing or what I was noticing. And for me, it makes a lot of sense. That's really why I stuck with the path for so long, is that all of it just makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. And you can totally say, I don't want to answer this. So if that's the case, I will completely just edit it out. But like, would you be willing to give us a personal example of like a thing that you've worked on in this way? Like whether it's a behavior or, you know, like a repetitive thought pattern or anything like that, and like how you saw that actually shift?
Yeah, I think, well, the one that's been coming up for me lately while I've been on quarantine is the scarcity as a trauma. And, you know, I grew up as an immigrant. I grew up in a fairly low to middle class family. I had a mother that was very motivated by scarcity. And that kind of filtered through in my life. And, you know, like in moments where all your work in the middle of a pandemic gets canceled, I start to notice, you know, in myself, like this grasping and clinging to things, and just noting how much that comes up in my body. And, you know, this one has been something new that I've worked on that, you know, that hasn't come up in meditation practice, but lately for me, it's to be just really able to sit with the thoughts and the feelings around that, develop compassionate space for it to just be there as a response to, you know, my childhood and upbringing, and to choose wisely, you know, how I respond to that moment that is triggering me so much with scarcity. Like, how am I going to respond now? Am I going to respond with compassion and wisdom and awareness, or am I going to retract into my habitual responses? You know, that's one thing, but I think probably, you know, deeper things that I've worked on has been with fear. You know, fear has been a big thing in my life, and sadness and loneliness. Those things I've had to really sit with and explore.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. I think scarcity is something we're all probably could relate to a little bit at the moment, with the totally unforeseen circumstances that that most people are in right now. And on this, like just digging a tiny little bit deeper into this particular topic of like taking your meditation practice beyond, like in addition to, but beyond just those more, you know, day-to-day benefits, do you think that like there's a place for the meditation apps and then there's a place for having an actual relationship with a meditation teacher? And like, how would someone start to understand where they are in relation to like, is an app better for me, or am I more aligned with actually finding an in-person relationship?
Yeah, I think that there definitely is a place for apps. I think purely from an accessibility perspective, a lot of us, you know, really come to the practice through that. And I think it's a really good place to begin, you know, provided that you're doing using an app that's, you know, reputable, that has some legitimate teachers. I think it's really, really useful. And then, you know, that might be where you stay for lots of years, and that's okay. Like, I think there's nothing wrong with the therapeutic benefits of practice. There's nothing wrong with reducing stress. There's nothing wrong with sleeping better. There's nothing wrong with being more present. Like, that's amazing. And if all you do in your whole life are those things, if all you do in your whole life is those things, then, you know, that's already a win. I think a teacher is really helpful when we have questions. And inevitably, we will, if we go deep enough into the path, we will have questions. You know, one of the questions that I constantly feel from students that have come from apps into our studios is, am I doing it right? You know, that's like a basic question. But then it's like, you know, why am I always angry? That's another question. Or why does this particular feeling come up? Or why is my shoulder tense up? You know, these are things you can't really ask a meditation app. So in those instances, I think a teacher is so helpful. But beyond that, I think what's really also needed is a community. And, you know, in Buddhist practice, we talk a lot about the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. And the Sangha is the community. The Sangha is really what holds you accountable, but what also a place you can find refuge, you know, a place where you don't have to feel like you're alone, a place where there are people probably contemplating the exact same questions as you. And when you can really connect with a Sangha or a community, that's when I found in my personal practice, that's when it really begins to transform. That's when it really begins to gain momentum, you know, when you can surround yourself with people contemplating the same questions.
If someone's interested, like they're listening, they're like, yeah, I totally need that. I know the world is a bit, you know, upside down right now, but how would you go about finding a meditation teacher? Like, I know that that there are some places, like you have a studio when you're allowed to have an in-person studio. But for a lot of people listening, they might not have that available. Like, how do you actually find a teacher?
Yeah, well, I think that the best thing that's happened out of this pandemic is that everyone has literally gone online. So even me, I'm finally able to practice with teachers I've only dreamt of practicing with. So I think that's really cool. I think you have to really ask yourself what it is you want to achieve through practice, and then find what path that you want to follow. So if it's secular mindfulness practice, then obviously there's MBSR. And you can find a bunch of incredible teachers, you know, through the MBSR website. If it's the Buddhist path, then, you know, Insight Meditation Society is one of the best that I know of, and I practice with them a lot. You know, Sharon Salzberg, Joseph Goldstein, Jack Kornfield, they all teach out of that tradition. If it's the Tibetan Buddhist path, there's a number of other teachers, Lama Rod Owens, Lodra Rinzler, you know, my mentor, Dr. Miles Neal, Joe Loizio, there's so many, but it probably depends on the path that you want to follow and the motivation that you have. And from there, a little bit of research from Google will be able to help you.
And personally, I found even with like in my yoga practice looking for a teacher, it's sometimes like their bio seems exactly like what you need. But when you, or like their, you know, their training and their style, but when you actually meet with the person, there's either, and it can be online, like one of my teachers I meet with online and just always have because I'm here in Australia and she's in the States. But like there's a connection as well. So like or there's not a connection. And so I've been like, oh, okay, cool. Like I thought maybe you were my teacher, but like sometimes you can just tell. Like I wish there was like a better, like more practical system thing. But like I literally cried when I sat in person with one of my teachers for the first time. And I was like, oh my God, this is it. It was like, yeah, I mean, like a resonance or something that happens.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I mean, you know, in my perspective, I think there's a lot of karmic forces at play that bring you to certain teachers at certain times in your life. But, you know, a system that I tend to use when I'm, you know, looking for a teacher or when I, you know, interview teachers for A-Space, is, you know, a good teacher usually has compassion and wisdom. You know, like those are two things that, especially in the meditation world, I would first of all start by looking at, you know, like, do they have that? And the second thing is usually like, what lineage or what have they studied? So, you know, to be an MBSR teacher, you have to go through years of practice, which is really beautiful, similar to a insight meditation teacher. There's years of study that you have to go through there. Then there's, you know, UCLA that does like an amazing mindfulness teacher training course. Anyone that goes through those few things, I'm like, okay, they're at least well trained. But then I look at, you know, then I look at, I observe their students. What are their students like? Are their students compassionate? Are they humble? Are they kind? Or are they, just partying all the time when they're angry and they're grumpy? That's a pretty good indication. And then, you know, if you have the ability to be with someone in person, like, what are they like around their friends, around their family? Do they live what they teach? You know, that's an observation. And then probably one of the most important things is, how do you feel when you're in their presence? And, you know, you said it really beautifully. You felt such a deep connection and tears. And I think, you know, that's a good indication. Like, how do you feel in their presence? Do you feel calm? Do you feel seen? Do you feel heard? You know, there's a lot also at play there, you know, psychologically, but I think it's a good indication of where to begin. And then ultimately your teacher is really like a spiritual friend. You know, they have this ability to, you know, be those things to you, but also they're not a god, I don't think. You know, like teachers that position themselves as you know, gurus and things like that. I've met many gurus in my life, and the gurus that I've met have never told me that they're a guru, and they never position themselves as that, even though their students might. They don't really position themselves as that. So I think, you know, if you look at those things as a system in which to analyze if a teacher is legit and if a teacher is someone that you would potentially connect to, that I think it's a good way to analyze it.
Yeah, that's super helpful. Better than just like sitting down in front of them and seeing if you cry. I think it's actually a lot more practical for people. And there's something that I really wanted to talk to you about, and I've been having this conversation with almost anyone who will have it with me. And like, you know, yoga has gone through such like a dismantling of our traditional sort of lineage system, in that in the last like 5 years or so, it's been brought to light that the behavior of many like lineage holders, like the head of different lineages, and also many people just within the lineage, have been abusing people, sometimes in isolated instances, sometimes sort of systematically throughout their entire teaching life. And meditation, some schools of meditation are going through similar things. And I think like we're in this weird stage where like everybody used to want to have a teacher and used to want to have, at least like in the circles I was running in, and wanted to have a guru. And now like people are questioning that because they've seen so much harm been caused in these different traditions. And like, do you have any thoughts on how we sort of move forward as a yoga and meditation community of like not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak, like keeping some, keeping something of those lineages, because there is so much wisdom within them, but also it's kind of like so hard to swallow the teachings of someone who, you know, raped their students for decades. Like, do you have any thoughts of like, how do we keep that wisdom, but without supporting or condoning the people who caused that much harm, who perpetuated that wisdom also?
Yeah. Well, I think first of all, like there is no condoning of any of that behavior.
Yeah.
So regardless if it was done under the guise of spirituality or yoga or meditation or whatever it is, I think that's just tapping into the worst part of our own humanity, is to reach into those dark places and abuse really the practice and in turn another person. So I don't think we could use that as a as almost a cloak to say this is spiritual. I think the I love the analogy of don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, because I feel personally like we have a tendency in the West to do that. You know, we don't like something, we immediately, it's like cancel culture, right? Like that's it. We're no longer doing this. And I think that there should be ramifications for anyone that takes advantage of people, especially in meditation circles, because there's such vulnerability of people that are coming in there. And also we all have our own psychology, right? Like we're all drawn to certain teachers. We're all drawn to certain people. And that's because of the experiences that we have had. So there's so many things that are at play. The nuance here is that when we do throw the baby out with the bathwater, we're essentially, especially when it comes to meditation, we're throwing out lineages and traditions that have historically come from certain regions of this planet, usually in the East. Let's just call it out. Let's just use that as an example, not just there, but usually in the East. And so what we can tend to do is we can tend to co-opt that, and we can tend to, you know, with the best of intentions, appropriate that to be something that becomes palatable to our Western sensibilities. And again, it's a nuanced discussion, because some of that is so beneficial to people, you know, to have a practice that is just devoid of any sort of spiritual elements and any sort of religious overtones can be really beneficial to a lot of people. But in the process, we're feeding into colonial systems that have been at play for centuries, you know, and that's a real thing. Orientalism and colonization has been part of the fabric of, you know, yoga and meditation practices for years. So it's a nuanced conversation, and I don't have a really strong answer, because I'm still navigating it within myself. But I think it's really important as students and even as teachers to be very discerning as to who we decide to follow. And because of what has happened, potentially how we are in fact showing up for our communities and our students, if we throw the proverbial baby out with the bathwater, and what we can learn within that process, you know. And I know, for example, that all the controversy with Bikram, like I couldn't even imagine what it would be like to be a student of his that has studied with him for years and years and years, and then has potentially opened up a studio, and now everything has come out. Like I wouldn't even know what that's like. So it's a very nuanced and complex conversation, but I think there are a lot of considerations for people to contemplate. And one of them is, yes, what are we foregoing in making it palatable for us, but also what are we accepting by not, you know, being discerning enough with the people that that are doing these things?
Have you ever, and I'm asking because I definitely have, but have you ever had like a crisis of faith, for lack of a better word, of like, if these teachings worked, why are the people teaching them doing this shit? Like, I mean, I have transformed parts of myself and my psyche and continue to do so through these teachings. So like, I know they work for me, but like, how does this happen? Like, I'm not expecting you to have an answer. I'm just sort of like wondering from like one practitioner to another, you know, have you ever questioned like, if you were doing all the yoga and the meditation, what, like, how did this happen? I don't know. Have you ever like,
yeah,
been down, well, that I think, train?
Absolutely. Like whenever I hear a new scandal, I'm like, you know, what is going on? And you know, it's again, I think there's so many different answers to this. Like for me, I reckon with the humanity of these experiences. I know within me there is the potential to do great harm. You know, I know that. You know, I've probably caused great harm in relationships and, you know, friendships over the years. But I've also done a lot of good within that. And knowing that, I know that we can contain both. You know, people can do great harm and people can do great good. That doesn't mean, you know, we ever excuse people that are in positions of power that do it. But I think that's just reality that happens. But also, like, it's all a hypothesis, right? At the end of the day, like, you know, I talk about karma a lot. I talk about, you know, enlightenment a lot. And, you know, one of our teachers, Robina Curtin, a fierce Tibetan Buddhist teacher, talks a lot about all of this being a hypothesis, right? This is my working hypothesis. And if I get to the end and all I've done is be a good person and I've not harmed anyone and I've, you know, being compassionate and kind and generous and virtuous, then I'm okay with that. But the best case scenario is that I awaken. Worst case scenario is all I've done is this. So, I mean, all of these teachings are really a hypothesis. Like, no one knows what's going to happen when we die. But if we live virtuously, which I think is, you know, probably a really a good segue when we talk about, you know, secular versus non-secular practices. If we really take on ethics and virtue as being a part of our spiritual practice, they can help us individually. Not to say that it's helped some of these teachers who have, you know, done some bad things, but I think they can help us individually navigate some of these situations.
Dumb question. In like secular meditation and mindfulness, are the ethics like removed? Like, is that something that's not discussed, or is that still contained?
I think that's a point of great controversy at the moment. You know, people that are saying that, you know, these days mindfulness is essentially an appropriate version of the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the four foundations of mindfulness that started in Buddhism, which contains a heavy focus on ethics, which contains a heavy focus on conduct. And I think, you know, Jon Kabat-Zinn, much to his devotion to his practices, really wanted to make a practice and a modality of teaching palatable to people, you know, in the 60s and 70s. So to talk about God, to talk about, you know, not that we talk about God in Buddhism, but to talk about anything that might be associated with religion might not have been palatable. And look, we're seeing that today, right? The mere mention of anything spiritual or godlike, you know, sends people into hysteria, which is fair enough. Like, it's not for everyone. But I think ethics is really important when it comes to developing someone's spiritual practice. And you can create your own form of ethics, or, you know, I've chosen to follow a set of teachings and ethics that have been around for 2,500 years.
Okay, thanks for sharing that. The people who listen are yoga teachers who are all very familiar with the ethics, you know, Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, Yamas and Niyamas. Would you just mind, if you've got them like in the top of your head, just giving us like a basic outline of the ethics that the system that you practice puts forth?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of different ones. You know, we take what's called the five precepts, which are, you know, before we begin practice, we kind of take these precepts as a way of being, almost like a motivation or an intention. You know, not in any particular order. It's like non-harming any living beings, not stealing, not taking things that aren't freely given, sexual misconduct, not using our sexual power to harm anyone, lying or false speech, and then, you know, taking, you know, drugs or anything that intoxicates our mind. And we call it, you know, anything that causes heedlessness. Those are some initial precepts that we take. But then the Eightfold Path has, which the Buddha prescribed as part of his Four Noble Truths, speaks about, you know, right view, like seeing things clearly, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And within that, there is a whole section on moralities and ethics as well. So it's, you know, if we want to boil it all down to one thing, it's like, don't cause harm. And what does that look like is what opens up a bigger discussion.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the Yoga Sutra lays out something very similar. So I think that it's, lots of people have discovered that these things generally help you live a good life if you can use them as sort of like a compass, which you refer back to. I want to bring it back, if we could, just, you know, thinking a little bit about what you've just mentioned in terms of like not causing harm and the harm that has been caused in the yoga and meditation communities. Do you think that, like, again, I'm not expecting you to like have the answer, but just like your thought and idea around this, because it's been something that I've been thinking about a lot lately. Do you think it has to do with the way like power and capitalism in the West have sort of embedded or like married into these spiritual teachings, and that like people who have moved away from the ethics and perhaps living like a more simple life have taken on some of like the values of Western culture around like power and money and fame and everything? Do you think that that has sort of like, for some people, overshadowed the original teachings, and perhaps that's why we see these issues? Or I don't know. Do you have any thoughts around that?
Yeah. Well, I think it's probably twofold. Like, I think that it's not just in the West. I think it's in the East as well.
Yeah, like, okay. Yeah.
When we talk about power, that's something that affects everyone, you know, and the Buddha talks a lot about, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion as being, you know, poisons. And the Buddha has a story, like right before he became enlightened, he saw this demon god called Mara. And Mara contained all of these poisons, you know, so sensuous desires and, you know, greed and power. And what the Buddha said right before he became enlightened was like, Mara, I see you. You know, so we see these tendencies, we see these desires as they come up. And I think for some people, like, that those poisons are sometimes too strong. You know, they're perhaps their moral compass isn't as strong. And I think that's perhaps why some of these, you know, some of these events and unfortunate situations have happened, that they haven't been able to really control those urges and then those sensibilities. But like, that's a very simplistic, reductionistic answer to, I think, very, very complex situations. And, you know, it's just, again, I think it's, we have these tendencies within us. So it's a human tendency. It's just how can we overcome them? How can we uproot them completely?
For anyone listening who is newer or newish, like, to this path of trying to incorporate ethics, whether they come from a yoga framework or a Buddhist framework or, you know, whatever religion or secular practice that they're taking on, like just in your own life, do you have any advice to give out for someone who's like grappling with their own humanity and also trying to live a life that is, you know, maybe they are a teacher and they're trying to, you know, air quotes, like live up to these things?
I think, you know, it's these days we talk about it perhaps in a similar way, which is core values. Like what are our core values? I think ethics is just a way of conducting ourselves in the world. And I think it's perhaps personal for people that are on the secular sort of tip to really sit down and consider like how are they showing up in the world. I think we live in a culture that really values things like independence, achievement, and these very masculine traits. We don't value things like interdependence, community, and in humility. And I think, you know, for me, when I look at the ethics and when I look at my own ethical framework, like I integrate those things. Like, what is it that I really want to value? Is it, as a teacher, is it like fame? Is it lots of money? Like, is that really important to me? And the answer is to an extent, but it's not why I'm motivated to teach. It's not what I do. So then that governs how I show up, whether that's online, whether that's in person, whether that's the types of companies that I work with. I've said no to certain companies that I ethically don't align with. So I think it's an individual exploration for sure. But if, you know, if the Buddhist framework is what appeals to them, or the yogic framework is what appeals to them, then get curious about it, you know, instead of blindly taking it on to be what's right, you know, and just accepting them, you know, unconsciously, question them, put them to the test. And, you know, the Buddha said that in his last sermon when he was teaching, is that don't believe anything I've said, or don't believe anything anyone has said, even if I've said it, unless it resonates with your own reason, unless it resonates with your own heart. And I think that's a good basis for us to take on anything that we haven't created ourselves.
Yeah, I think I've heard the Dalai Lama echo something very, very similar to that, and appreciated it because it empowers the student as well, which I think is, you know, one of the themes that you've brought up a couple of times without saying it outright, is that as individual students, you know, if we can resist like giving over our power to a particular teacher or teaching, and instead you know, reflect it back on our own sensibility, then it can help us lead a life that's maybe, or have a practice that's maybe a little bit more, I don't know what the word is, but like just not dependent on an outside force.
Yeah. I mean, I think generally good teachers or wise teachers really cultivate that capability within their students. And I think being discerning is part of your spiritual practice. You know, I think if not the basis of your spiritual practice, like, you know, in the Buddhist path, what we're really trying to do is see clearly. And part of seeing clearly is to notice when there are power dynamics at play, to notice when there are unwholesome traits that are coming up within ourselves or within others, and to have the confidence to be able to stand up for that. I think that's not exclusive of the spiritual practice. I think that is part of the spiritual practice.
Manoj, I'm just aware of the time. And before we wrap up, is there anything that we sort of like opened up in the conversation, but you feel like we haven't sort of tied it up in a way that you want to, or anything that's still sort of like hanging that you want to cover?
No, I think there's some really good questions. Like, what's your vibe?
No, I'm feeling good about it. I mean, I'm, as I said before, like I'm just a curious human being, so I could question things all day long. I spend a lot of time, you know, grappling with things in my own mind and just trying to understand, you know, myself. I studied psychology when I went to university and study and understand other people and people I know and people I don't know. So yeah, I could keep questioning all day. But the one thing I do want to ask you is, could you finish this sentence? If you really knew me, you would know.
that I'm human. And I'm just trying to work all of this out, just like you are. And I've perhaps spent a bit more time sitting down quietly observing the neuroses that is my own mind. But I'm human, and I think so are many of our teachers that we look up to.
Cool. Thank you so much for that. Before we go, could you just tell people, like, in this brave new world of online everything, what do you have happening at the moment?
Oh, sure. Not much. The only thing that that my studio A Space is doing is we're offering a 100% free daily meditation practice on our Instagram page. Cool. It's called the School of Deep Feelings, which is really being helped to help people navigate all the different feelings that they're going through. And we've had some of the world's best teachers, psychologists and Ayurvedic practitioners really share their craft to help people navigate this this new normal.
Awesome. And can people find that, like, on your personal Instagram or the A Space Instagram?
Yeah, they can find it on both. So at Minaj underscore or underscore A Space.
Cool. And just for people listening, can you tell us your website? Is it like A Space? And then you've got your own as well?
Yeah, aspace is a-space.com.au. Cool. And then Manoj Diaz is manojdias.com.au.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your time and for being willing just to question the shit out of all of that with me.
I enjoyed it. Such a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Teaching Yoga. To get full transcripts and links for all of the resources we discuss in this show, get yourself on the newsletter at coragerux.com/newsletter. That's coragerux.com/newsletter. If you don't keep it real, then you go somewhere but here, because you know we're only losing control just for a minute. Oh. If you don't like this music, then don't be listening to it. You know I'm just a dude that you know, or something similar. If you don't keep it real, can you go somewhere but here? Cause you know we're only losing control just for a minute. Oh, 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 oh,